Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest today is Anatole Levin, who is a professor in the Department of War Studies at King's College London and a senior fellow at the New America Foundation in Washington, D.C. For 12 years, he was a journalist for the Times of London and covered the first Afghan war. His new book is Pakistan, A Hard Country. Anatole, welcome back to our program.
Hello again.
How long did it take you to write this book?
Well, I started researching it in a way more than 20 years ago when I was a journalist in Pakistan for the Times in the late 80s. So some of the material in the book comes from that. And then I had a long gap in as a journalist in the former Soviet Union for the Times. And then after 9/11, I started working intensively on Pakistan again. And it's basically taken me about 3 years to research and write this particular book.
And you've done a lot of field research in the process of producing this book.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I lived there for 2 years previously. And out of the past 3 years, I've spent perhaps about 6 months in Pakistan. And yes, I visited all the provinces, all the main cities. And I've talked to, as well as members of the elites, and I've talked to probably by now, if not thousands, then over 1,000 ordinary people, you know, in what we journalists call vox pops on the street. So I hope I have an impression of what, you know, once again, not just the Pakistani establishment, but what ordinary Pakistanis feel about a lot of issues.
And your most recent trip was just in March of this year, 2011.
Yeah, came back last week.
Yeah. And what is the difficulty of being both an academic and a journalist? Is there a difficulty? I mean, academics are known, or it is alleged, that they have a greater sense of the big picture. But you, as a journalist, you really have your ear to the ground.
Well, yes. I mean, as a journalist, I suppose the advantages of being a journalist are that you're more attuned to the immediate issues, and perhaps that you're more comfortable with, you know, relatively informal but actually quite useful means of research. I mean, if I want to find out about public opinion, I don't feel I have to set up a massively systematic approach. You know, I can get general feelings on basic issues just by going out onto the street in different parts of town, obviously, and talking to people. The difficulty of being an academic writing on Pakistan is that on a lot of key issues, the basic research has not been done. The basic sociological studies of what is happening socially, economically, religiously, culturally in that country are simply not there. So you're thrown back, essentially, on informal means of research. I mean, I'm now trying to put together teams of PhD students of my own who will go out and research on Pakistan. But for a great deal of this book, I had to do my own research. Nobody else had done it.
And I noticed that in your book, history is very important, and some of the great studies in anthropology, actually, from a long time ago, really can get at some of the main problems.
Yes, well, because one of the curses of much of the media reporting on Pakistan, but also certain kinds of academic analysis as well, is that they assume that words that both we and the Pakistanis use mean the same thing, and very often they don't. Democracy in Pakistan does not work the same as democracy in America. The police don't work the same. The law doesn't work the same. So many things, although the English words are the same, are in fact different. And it's anthropology and history which gives you a sense of what these words really mean, where they come from, what the local content, if you like, is given to them.
And we'll pursue that idea in one moment, but why don't you give us a thumbnail sketch of Pakistan, population, geography, and so on?
Well, the first thing about Pakistan is that the population is huge. It's almost 200 million already. According to World Bank projections, unless they can bring the birth rate down much more steeply than they've done so far, it'll have 335 million by the middle of this century. That is putting appalling pressure on every kind of resources, jobs, education, and most importantly, water in the long run. So that's the most important underlying feature. It is this steep population growth in what is basically, by nature, a semi-arid country. The other thing which is very important about Pakistan, and in this Pakistan is more like India than either Pakistanis or Indians would like to admit, is the immense diversity of Pakistan, ethnic diversity, provincial diversity, cultural diversity, and religious diversity. Because what is often missed in Western reporting is that there are many different kinds of Islam in Pakistan. This isn't Iran with a basically monolithic form of Islam. And it's this diversity which is also frustrating the attempts of the Islamist revolutionaries to create a united revolution in Pakistan. So a lot of Pakistani life is about negotiating between these different groups or between these groups and the state and state forces. I mean, the final thing that as a Westerner really strikes you in Pakistan is how weak the state is, how weak the law is, the police, all the institutions that we take for granted are very weak in Pakistan, with one exception, which is, of course, the army.
Mm-hmm. And the key here, the driver of the dynamic, is kinship relationships. Explain that to us, because if you don't understand that, you can't understand Pakistan, is what you're saying in the book.
Yeah. It's not the only driver, but... Well, I mean, it's obvious if you look at Pakistan's political parties. All the main political parties are headed by dynasties. Incidentally, that's not particular to Pakistan. It's true to a great extent of India, it's true of Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, you know. And that reflects the fact that, yes, kinship is the single most important building block in society. Society in general, but also, of course, in political society. There's a saying in Pakistan that a man who doesn't have a strong family ties behind him can't be strong in any other way, because you have to have a solid, powerful family in order to achieve anything in that country. And I having surrendered to the SMS generation, I use a kind of SMS formula to describe the Pakistani political system, its fundamental dynamic. I call it P2K, patronage to kinship. These powerful kinship groups, political families, use their access to state resources to plunder the state and redistribute it to their followers. But what that means, by the way, is because they need followers, support to get access to these resources, that also means that they do have to distribute them. In a good old American phrase, they dunk, but they also have to splash, because otherwise their followers will abandon them. And that is what gives the system its surprising stability. I mean, if you look at Pakistani history, under, you know, the sort of froth and spray of political events, the basic structures have remained astonishingly constant over decades.
And you make the point that there are two sources of partial modernity, of transforming the system, one from the West and, in a funny kind of way, the Islamicists. And in both cases, neither succeed because of this kinship network and the use of patronage.
And because of the intense conservatism of much of the population, because we see the Islamist radicals as conservatives. In fact, in terms of their own system, they're radicals. Most Pakistanis still are attached to local traditions of worship, which are against the ideology of the radicals, especially the Wahhabi ideology of Al-Qaeda and to some extent the Taliban, which, of course, has been brought in from Saudi Arabia, but which is alien to many local traditions in Pakistan. I mean, that is changing to some extent. One shouldn't be complacent, especially urbanization is leading to changes in traditional religious patterns, but only relatively slowly. Once again, this isn't Iran.
Mm-hmm. And talk a little about the diversity of ethnicity and tribes. I mean, because this is, you call it a negotiated state dealing with different provinces, with different ethnic groups, with different kinship relationships. I mean, different in the sense that their identity is different from their neighbor.
Yes, Pakistan has four main provinces, of which one, Punjab, has more than 50% of the population. But actually, to say that gives in some ways a very misleading impression, because every province is also internally ethnically divided. And Punjab itself, the Punjabi language is not spoken by most Punjabis. There are many other languages within Punjab. Ethnicity, kinship, religious allegiance, region are equally important. And all of these things play a part in politics. And yes, these groups have to negotiate among themselves, and the state has to balance between them. In the book, there's a certain version which is taken up by certain naive Western observers that Pakistan is a Punjabi dictatorship. I take issue with this in the book. I think things are much more complicated. In that as well, Pakistan is more like India than people realize. You know, India works because it's a constant process of compromise between endless local groups, between states, between the center and the states, and so forth and so on. An Indian general who I quote in the book said to me many years ago that an attempt to create a really efficient centralized dictatorship in India would actually destroy the country within a year, because you have to have a system with that degree of flexibility and give. Well, Pakistan, of course, has had military dictatorships, but actually none of them have been efficient, because they too have had to compromise with all these local groups.
Mm-hmm. Now, putting aside the army, we'll focus on the army in a minute, explain what these kinship groups, this predatory quality toward institutions leads to. Talk about the police, the political parties. I mean, to what extent, because of this system, are they not what they appear to be in Western terms?
Well, the clearest problem is that Pakistan has the lowest rates of tax collection in South Asia, less than 10%. India has 17%. The others are scattered in the middle. The state is too weak to force these powerful groups in society to pay taxes. You could say that's true in America as well, but in Pakistan it's much worse and in a different way, which means, of course, that the state cannot get most aspects of development done. It can't afford to educate the population. It can't afford to build the necessary things, and so forth and so on. But in addition, even those revenues that it does raise are to a great extent plundered by the political elites. But the important thing to note is that they're, on the whole, they're not simply transferred. This isn't Nigeria. They're not simply transferred to bank accounts in London or New York or into Western property, because they have to be redistributed to followers. And that's what gives the system its stability, because a fair amount of the population does derive some benefit from this patronage, and this attaches them to the political elites, you see.
Where is Pakistani nationalism in all of this? Does it not exist? And what you then have is different regional nationalisms, or even they don't exist?
They coexist. There is such a thing as Pakistani nationalism, and it's very important in parts of Punjab, and it's very important, above all, of course, in the Pakistani army. which is recruited from those parts of Punjab and which, of course, regards itself as encapsulating Pakistani nationalism. But this nationalism coexists with all these other different allegiances at the same time. I'm also sorry to say that the Pakistani nationalism has proved very weak as a state-building force. It's proved pretty strong when it comes to sustaining hostility to India and increasingly, I'm afraid, to the United States as well.
Mm-hmm. And what about institutions such as the police and the judiciary? To what extent do they fulfill the Western definition of what police and judiciaries do? I'm not saying they should, but that is the way we measure them.
Very little, to be honest. I mean, the police is deeply corrupt and incompetent and largely in hock, of course, to local interest groups. It's relatively good at keeping basic order. In many ways, this is still a colonial police force. It operates under the British Indian Police Act of 1864. That's its basic, you know, standard operating procedure. So, you know, it's relatively good at cracking heads and stopping people from massacring each other or, you know, launching mass demonstrations. But it's terribly bad at what we would regard as modern policing. And partly in consequence and partly for its own reasons, the judicial system as a whole is monstrously slow and corrupt. And this is one of the things which has given the Islamist radicals their chance in parts of the country, because the appeal of the Sharia, therefore, is extremely strong. Not really the Sharia as such, but the Sharia as a kind of code for a better, fairer, cheaper, more accessible form of justice, you see.
Mm-hmm. What does corruption mean? What is it in a setting like this where kinship is so important?
Well, it basically consists of using your support in society to get some kind of handle on the state, either as a civil servant or through elections, and then basically ripping off state resources, state contracts, licenses, that whole thing. But as I say, distributing some of the benefits. Corruption and patronage is one side of it. The other is protection. This is potentially, at least, a very violent society. And you need a grip on the state so that you can use the police to defend yourself against local rivals or to attack local rivals. Or if they try to use one police officer against you, you need to have another police officer to cancel that out. So protection is also a very important part of this equation.
You explain in the book that as you understand this dynamic, then Western notions of what human rights would look like are then very different from a Pakistani, an understanding of the Pakistani situation. Talk a little about that, because when we look at a country and say, well, there are human rights violations, the assumption is that it's really the state that is doing it. And you say something else is going on here.
That's exactly it. Because, you know, because of our European experiences of Nazism and communism, we see the greatest human rights abuses as coming from the state. Now, in Pakistan, the state does commit human rights abuses. I was up in the district of Swat 2 weeks ago, and the army there, as part of the campaign against the Taliban, has been conducting quite a lot of extrajudicial executions. That's, you know, human rights abuses by the state. But most of the human rights abuses in Pakistani society, especially against women, have nothing to do with the state. This is forces in local society, sometimes dominant groups. Sometimes, it must be said, actually a consensus of the local men in a given local clan who impose these ghastly punishments, you know, on women who are seen to step out of line or couples who marry without sanction. and so forth and so on. And that, you see, is not the work of the state. It's a reflection, actually, of the weakness of the state, which can't impose its own law on these often very savage local tribal traditions.
The subtitle of your book is A Hard Country, and then you were considering, I read somewhere, you calling it a negotiated state. Talk a little about that, because is it this dynamic that you've just described that leads to the difficulty of comprehending the country on the one hand, but also the need for negotiation?
Well, that's just it, because, you know, once again, we have an idea. You know, even though our own systems we know are often actually don't work this way, but we still have a kind of ideal form in our head which says there is a law passed by, you know, the legislature, the law is obeyed by the great majority of society. Anyone who doesn't obey it is a criminal and outside the system. The executive exists to implement the law, and within the executive, decisions are passed down, you know, by legally appointed authorities and are obeyed, you know, by their subordinates through the system. In the judiciary, judgments are given, judgments are obeyed, people are either acquitted or sent to jail. It doesn't work like that in Pakistan. You know, orders are given, but they then have to be negotiated and are either ignored altogether or end up looking like something very different. It's very difficult to get convictions before the judiciary, convictions of anyone with any power or influence. When you do get them, they're often released under political pressure very quickly. In the police, I mean, much policing work, actually at its best, is about arranging compromises between the rival families. Or it's not about punishment, it's about negotiation. So yes, negotiation is simply integral to this whole system. But violence, or the threat of violence, is also part of the negotiations. I have to say I'm a fan of the series The Sopranos, and you see so many aspects of that in Pakistan. Not that violence is always used, or even most of the time, but it's always there in the background as part of the negotiations.
You write that Pakistan is Janus-faced. What holds Islamic extremism in check also holds back Pakistan's social, economic, and political development. Pakistan is divided, disorganized, economically backward, violent, unjust, often savagely oppressive toward the poor and women, and yet it moves, and is in many ways surprisingly tough and resilient.
Mm. Yeah.
So that in the end result, the poverty, the social welfare is often dire, but the system stays together.
Yeah, exactly that.
The exception, of course, is the army. Let's talk about that, because yours is a very detailed portrait of maybe the only modern institution that really has separated itself from this dynamic of kinship.
To a degree, but what I say in the book is that the army has succeeded in doing this, and it really has done it. It is the only meritocratic institution in the country, really. But it's done so by turning itself into a kind of giant kinship group and extracting a huge proportion of the state resources and redistributing those resources to itself. Now, not generally in a corrupt way or not a kleptocratic way, in quite an orderly way, the benefits are distributed down through the military and also go to, you know, provide weapons and training and accommodation and everything. So there's two sides to this. If the military were simply the Nigerian military, it would take all these resources and then it would just steal them. The generals would steal them, transfer them to bank accounts in London and so forth. But equally, without all those resources, the army couldn't be honest and meritocratic in the way that it is. Because, you know, the classic thing I describe in the book, a journalist friend talking about two friends of his who are retiring in the next year. A general, a colonel, I think, and a police officer. The colonel has waiting for him a job with a military industry, a plot of land, you know, which he's been able to buy on very easy terms, with a nice house, and therefore a comfortable, secure retirement. The police officer has none of these things. Therefore, the colonel can afford to be honest. He doesn't steal from the military. You could call giving him cheap land a form of corruption, but that's a bit like, you know, US generals stepping into jobs with the military-industrial complex. The superintendent of police has to steal. He has to be corrupt in order to secure his retirement. So these two things go together. I mean, the Pakistani military is an impressive institution, but it couldn't be an impressive institution if it didn't have such a disproportionately huge chunk of the resources of the Pakistani state.
So in what you're saying is that the military, in addition to being a military and all that goes with that, has also embraced a social welfare system
for
its own soldiers.
Yes.
But also it's a business enterprise, mm-hmm. basically, with the management of companies. So it's a mini state within a weak state.
Absolutely. And if you like cornflakes, then every day at breakfast, you will eat Fauji cornflakes, army cornflakes, which are produced by one of the army's industries, you see. Yes, just that. But one does have to say, of course, the Pakistani military has faced serious problems of morale in fighting the Islamist militants in Pakistan, because many of the ordinary soldiers at the beginning, and even to a degree today, really didn't want to do this. They were deeply humiliated by being told by their own families, their own villages, that they were acting as slaves of the Americans, that they were killing fellow Muslims on the orders of America. Now, in these circumstances, anything that helps maintain military morale, loyalty and discipline can't be altogether bad, because the consequences of a mutiny from below in the Pakistani army would be catastrophic.
Mm-hmm. Let's understand what it is that enable the military to become what you just described. Is there a historical background dating from the British that led to their on the one hand, isolation from society and the preservation of identity and integrity?
Yes, I mean, the army is the one British-instilled institution which has really worked. And one of the reasons for that is that the British did sort of fuse it with local warrior traditions, so that the profession of arms, if you will, always had great prestige in that society. And rather a good synthesis was created out of those two things. Whereas trying to create a synthesis between the British civil service tradition and an utterly different local tradition of government was much more difficult and has largely failed. So yes, I mean, the British, well, if you basically approve of the Pakistani army, then you could say that the British did achieve something there.
And what is the ethnic makeup of the soldiers? Is it representative of the country as a whole?
Not at all. Yeah. The officer corps, yes. You know, if you look at the military rulers of Pakistan, they have come from a range, or the chiefs of staff, a range of very different backgrounds. Look at Musharraf. You know, he was a middle-class Muhajir from Karachi, born originally in India. But the rank and file are still chiefly, though no longer exclusively, from those areas from which the British drew their recruits, which is to say a few districts of northwestern Punjab and the Pashtuns or Pathans of the northwest frontier province. And that also creates a certain problem, because those are areas, of course, where the Pakistani Taliban has made very great inroads, which is another reason why, you know, you do have to worry in certain circumstances about the morale and will of the military to fight.
So that the mission I assume you're saying that the perception of the public in Pakistan toward the military up until this point has remained very positive. Now, is that correct?
Well, it comes and goes, you see. The thing is that when the military takes political power, it always, over time, greatly damages its prestige, because government in Pakistan is always unpopular, because government simply cannot do what ordinary people want or need, and government is always corrupt, and so whether it's a military government or a civilian government. So after a period of military rule, the military becomes unpopular again. But then after a while, the politicians, of course, disgrace themselves. The military reestablishes its prestige as a sort of neutral defender of the country. The military does some things well. It's called in by the state to run things, which it does efficiently, like flood relief last year, which the military did so much better than the civilian institutions. And so after a while, the military reestablishes its prestige, and the civilian political parties lose theirs, and you're back to square one again.
Mm-hmm. Now, the whole key to military identity is the relationship with India, the perception of India. Mm-hmm. Talk about that, because that is really the heart of many of the problems in this region.
Yeah. Well, you know, Pakistan went to war with India within 2 months of its independence. Pakistan was, of course, also born in the most sort of savage communal massacres between Hindus, Sikhs, and Muslims, and which particularly affected Punjab, from which most of the soldiers are drawn. So the social legacy of hostility to India is enormous. Incidentally, it should be said that this is true to a considerable extent on the Indian side as well. I mean, there is also, of course, deep Indian hostility to Pakistan. This was then confirmed over the years by these endless low-level battles over Kashmir. And virtually every Pakistani soldier, like many Indian soldiers, has spent large parts of their career deployed on the border in Kashmir, taking occasional pot shots at the Indians. So this has made not just hostility to India, but specifically commitment to the quote-unquote liberation of Kashmir from India, a very, very important element in military thinking.
And Kashmir is a contested area between India and Pakistan since the founding of both states.
Well, since two months after the founding of those states, when the state split, essentially. The Muslim majority revolted against the Hindu Maharaja. The Indians then came in and took about most of the state, or most of the populated areas of the state, and Pakistan got what was left. And ever since then, the Pakistanis have dreamed, by one means or another, of pushing the Indians out. Now, the most important thing, of course, over the past 20 years, has been that the Pakistani military tried to use Islamist militant groups to attack the Indians, first in Kashmir and then more widely, to try to drive the Indians out by guerrilla warfare and terrorism. And that, both, of course, absolutely infuriated the Indians. It didn't achieve anything for Pakistan at all, but it also contributed to strengthening these militant groups within Pakistan itself. And some of these groups or their followers have now gone to support the Pakistani Taliban in rebellion against the Pakistani state.
Now, as a realist, explain to us how size matters here. The size of the Indian military versus the size of the Pakistani military.
Well, it's becoming, I mean, simply, you know, so disproportionate that even many Pakistani generals now recognize that this simply cannot be sustained in the long run. The Indian military budget for this year, if I remember rightly, is $37 billion equivalent. The Pakistani military budget is $4 billion. The Indian economy, of course, is rising at a rate more than twice that of Pakistan. If you look into the future, you know, Pakistan's ability to sustain this rivalry looks simply impossible. And so there is now the beginning of serious thought in Pakistan, which Musharraf reflected very strongly, that we do need to work out some kind of compromise with the Indians. The problem is, though, that the Indians, because they're getting so much stronger and because they're very angry with the Pakistanis about these terrorist attacks, are not really in any mood to compromise, most of them. Even though they could actually, by now, I think, get by far the greater part of what they want if they were prepared really to save Pakistan's face with, you know, certain kind of paper concessions. I'm not sure the Indian political system can generate those concessions. It's a bit like the Israelis and the Palestinians, you know.
So for Pakistan, Afghanistan is critical to its perception of India, and it leads to a fear that if India dominates a future Afghanistan in alliance with the northern tribes in Afghanistan, then Pakistan feels threatened by that and encircled.
Precisely, yeah. I mean, that is the driving force now of Pakistani shelter for the Afghan Taliban, shall we say, the most important thing. Not the only force. I mean, the other thing that people often forget is that the Afghan Taliban have absolutely overwhelming sympathy within Pakistani society, not as an ideological force, but as a force of what is seen, I'm sorry to say, as legitimate resistance against American occupation of Afghanistan. So these two things go together, the strategic calculations of the Pakistani military and the sentiments of the Pakistani masses, especially, of course, the Pashtuns along the border. But I don't think that this is set in stone. There are now really serious proposals being made in private by the Pakistani Chief of Staff, General Kayani, to America, proposals for a peace settlement in Afghanistan, which would embody the Taliban, but which would not give the Taliban control or domination of Afghanistan. So it's not that the Pakistanis are now dreaming, as they did in the 1990s, of simply turning Afghanistan into a client state of their own. They've learned that that doesn't work and is certainly not going to happen. But at the same time, they do very strongly believe that any peace settlement will have to involve a deal with the Taliban.
Now, explain to our audience the relationship of the military to the ISI, the intelligence services, and then both of their relationships to the Afghan Taliban.
Well, the ISI are the principal military intelligence service. There are others, but they needn't concern us. The ISI was tasked in the 1980s when I was there with supporting the Afghan Mujahideen. They cooperated with the CIA to back the Afghan Mujahideen against the Soviets and their communist allies. The ISI was also tasked with backing the militant groups who were conducting the jihad in Kashmir against India in the 1990s. Now, the ISI as a whole is simply part of the military. It's the present Chief of Staff, General Kayani, was previously head of the ISI. The senior commanders of the ISI are seconded military officers, not professional spies. So this notion that the ISI can make separate strategies is not true and is sometimes used as a convenient excuse, I think, by the Pakistani military to try to sort of evade responsibility. That said, of course, all intelligence services, and we have some experience of this, you know, with Western intelligence services as well, because of the kind of people they attract and because of the ways in which they work, are always liable to produce rogue elements, you know, who then essentially ally with the people they're supposed to be using and carry out at least limited operations of their own without the knowledge of the high command. So what I would say is the notion of the ISI as a separate institution is wrong, but undoubtedly you have individual ISI people who pursue their own agendas, and pretty often, I'm afraid, through by now more than 20 years of working closely with jihadi groups, those agendas are often jihadi.
Mm-hmm. Now, this is a very complex puzzle.
Yes.
Let's try to get a handle on this for our audience. What you have is people, Pakistani groups that are on both sides of the border, that is the Pathans. And so there is a lack of a clear demarcation, which is historically the case. You have the ISI supporting the Afghan Taliban, especially in an earlier period, because of its concerns about India. You have tribal regions on the border, which historically Pakistan has never really controlled. And you now have a dynamic in which the Western, especially the U.S., concern about its Afghan war going on now leads to a situation of turmoil with all of these groups. So let's talk about that, because the support for the Afghan Taliban lies at the border regions, and it's really led to the emergence of something new, which is a Pakistan Taliban.
Exactly. I mean, this goes back to the 1980s. I mean, we are partly responsible for this. We, together with the Pakistanis, backed Afghan guerrillas based in the Pashtun tribal areas of Pakistan to cross into Afghanistan to attack the Soviets. In the view of the local people, the Afghan Taliban are exactly the same. There is no difference. And indeed, they're partly right. Many of them are the same. They're the same people, or the sons or grandsons of the same people. And in the process, yes, the border between Afghanistan and Pakistan, which, by the way, Afghanistan has never recognized because it was a British-drawn border, has become extremely fluid. In both directions, by the way, I discovered in Swat that most probably the leaders of the Pakistani Taliban, who were driven out of Swat in Pakistan, have taken refuge in Afghanistan. So our, if you like, our radicals from Afghanistan, the Afghan Taliban, are sheltering in Pakistan. Their radicals from Pakistan, the Pakistani Taliban, are sheltering in Afghanistan. This is an aspect of things which, of course, is not much noticed by the Western media, but it's entirely true. So, yes, you have a Pashtun ethnicity which straddles that border. Most of them numerically are actually in Pakistan, the greater part of which is by now very hostile to the Western military presence, even when they don't support the Taliban ideologically. I mean, it was the son of a senior politician in the Awami National Party in Pakistan, which we think of as a secular party and which is very anti-Taliban. But he said to me, part of the problem is that every Pashtun is brought up to believe from their cradle that to resist foreign occupation is part of what it is to follow the Pashtun way, you see. So the Taliban, when they appeal to people, when they say we're just trying to liberate our countries from the infidel American occupier, that has tremendous resonance in Pashtun culture. Then, yes, you have the Pakistani military and the ISI, who are not, I would say, with certain exceptions, giving active support to the Afghan Taliban. If they were giving support, the Taliban would be much more like the Mujahideen. In other words, they'd be killing not hundreds but thousands of Western soldiers. But they are giving them shelter, yes. And the leadership of the Afghan Taliban, the Pakistanis know exactly where they are.
What is the dynamic in the tribal regions? Because in your book, you give us insight into the link of rebellion and the history of the state doesn't control those areas, and this is leading to the exaggeration of a dynamic that existed before, when we pushed the Pakistani army to try to seize control in a way that they never had before.
Well, that's it. I mean, the book is dedicated, amongst others, to my uncle, who was a British officer who fought against a rebellion. An Islamist rebellion in Waziristan in the 1930s, precisely the area where much of the Afghan Taliban is based, but also the heartland of Islamist revolt against Pakistan. But this tradition goes back 100 years before that. in that region. So yes, it's an old tradition, and frankly, I mean, any British officer of the past could have predicted exactly what would happen if you tried to, you know, instill a large Western army into the middle of this population. But yes, when the Pakistanis went in under Western pressure into their tribal areas, they were also seen to a great extent as foreigners, or at least working as for foreigners. And yes, that set off the tribal Islamist revolt, which continues to this day.
Now, what does all of this tell us about U.S. policy toward that, toward the Afghan war, toward that region, and toward pressure on the Pakistani military? Because earlier you said to us, well, the problem here is the Pakistan military is walking a tightrope in the sense that it can't be seen as turning against its own people, or those people part of Pakistan that provides some of the recruits for the military.
Yes. I mean, equally, of course, the Pakistani military can't simply tell America to go to hell. They do dream of that. But for that, they would have to have really solid backing from the Chinese, which they don't have at this stage. The Chinese are not anxious to get involved in a major bust-up between Pakistan and the US. So they have to do a certain amount of what America wants. They also, of course, I mean, take drone attacks on the tribal areas. On the one hand, the Pakistani population hates it. The rank and file of the Pakistani military find it deeply humiliating. On the other hand, of course, the Pakistanis also use this to target their own militants, you know, give the Americans information so they can target Pakistani militants in the frontier. So it's, you know, they have to, yes, I mean, pursue this diagonal policy balancing between the pressures of their own population and the pressures of the United States. That's why they are so desperately anxious for a peace settlement in Afghanistan, which would get the US off their necks or force them to withdraw. But the one thing where the Pakistanis, however, are fully on side, the Pakistani military and intelligence services, is preventing terrorist attacks against the United States itself. Not in Afghanistan, but against the territory of the United States or of Britain.
It's important to emphasize, so what in this dynamic that we've been describing, what emerged was a Pakistani Taliban, which at some point the Pakistani state and military came to see as a threat, different from its support for the Afghan Taliban in the past.
Precisely that, yes. I mean, they hesitated for a long time about really crushing these people. But by the spring of 2009, they were seen as a really serious threat to the Pakistani state. And the state and military have counterattacked against them actually very successfully. SWAT has now been pacified. The Taliban have been driven out.
Now, what is the red flag here for American policy? The drone strikes seem to be a negotiated solution, to use your terms, that the Pakistan military is willing to accept. But American special forces operating in these tribal areas, you're suggesting, would be a disaster.
Well, yes, because, as I was told by soldiers, the thing about drone strikes is that your ordinary Pakistani soldier can't do anything about them. If American soldiers come in on the ground, he can do something about that. He can fight, and his own family will expect him to fight. If he doesn't fight, he will be disgraced, you know, in the eyes of his own home communities. And, you know, that would put colossal strain on the loyalty and discipline of the army.
Mm-hmm. Now, we haven't talked about the nuclear weapons, but is there any threat here posed by disaffected soldiers because of what's happening in the tribal areas, somehow undermining the security of the Pakistani nuclear forces? Or are we making an imaginary threat here?
Not completely, but the thing is, as long as the army sticks together and the state sticks together, then there is no real threat there because, you know, by definition, these are highly defended installations and weapons, defended by the best troops that Pakistan has. They are, after all, its strategic crown jewels, as a Pakistani general put it to me. So no, as long as things hold together, that's fine. But of course, if the army were to split, if there were to be mutiny within the army and the state were to collapse, then yes, I mean, that would be a very serious danger. I mean, one of the points I make in the book, though, is, I mean, one of the things which would be most likely to bring this nightmare scenario about is if America launched some premature preemptive strike of its own in an effort to capture those weapons, because that would be seen as monstrous. Well, I mean, it would be seen as a direct attack on Pakistan. And if the army high command refused to fight back, then Pakistani soldiers would do it on their own, if you see what I mean. Mm-hmm. So that's why, you know, we, as I've said again and again, only Pakistan can govern Pakistan. Only Pakistanis can govern and control Pakistan. We cannot do this from outside, neither us nor the Indians. It's a very unsatisfactory relationship. It's always going to be unsatisfactory, but it's the only one we've got.
Mm-hmm. The ray of hope here in your book is the notion that because of Pakistan's prior influence on the Afghan Taliban, there is a possibility that they could play an important role in negotiating an exit strategy for the United States and a settlement in Afghanistan that would actually have to draw in the Indians also.
Yes, at least at the next stage.
Yeah.
It would have to draw in the Indians and the Iranians as well, and to a lesser extent the Chinese and the Russians. It would have to be a regional settlement. But insofar as, you know, it's Pakistan which has the access to the Afghan Taliban leadership, it would have to start with the Pakistanis. The thing is, though, that the Afghan Taliban have demonstrated again and again that they're nobody's puppets. They're not Pakistani puppets. The Pakistanis cannot simply tell them what to do. The Pakistanis have to be able to present to them a peace plan that they, the Taliban, could accept, or at least that they could begin to negotiate about. And the United States is still very, very far from being willing to produce such a plan.
We began in the beginning with talking about Pakistan's physical situation, its geography, and so on. And one of the important points in your book is that because it is in a valley around the Indus River, it really is vulnerable to climate change. Mm-hmm. And ironically, if we begin having more and more floods, Pakistan could really become a basket case, and who is going to be able to come in and aid their own people? Talk a little about that, because the Islamists have appeared to be able to do some of that when it's the Islamists and the army who seem to be able to respond to disasters.
Well, in terms of immediate humanitarian relief, yes. But neither of them have a solution to the desperate long-term structural problems, which are basically summed up by the fact that, you know, by the middle of this century, unless Pakistan can bring its birth rate down radically, there will be 335 million people living in what is naturally a semi-arid or even completely arid part of the world. Now, they have, since British days, you know, transformed much of their system through irrigation. But the irrigation is terribly wasteful and is horribly badly maintained. So you need both a huge investment in infrastructure, rebuilding, maintenance. But, I mean, on a scale that Pakistan itself cannot possibly afford, the figure that's been that I've seen floated is something in the region of $170 billion. But you also need just much more efficient use of agriculture. At present, it works basically on flood technology. You just flood the fields, you know, a form of technology going back to ancient Egypt 5,000 years ago. There are far more efficient ways of doing this. But, of course, that too will require education, incentives, you know, all this kind of thing, which the Pakistani state at present is not capable of creating. And the threat is, of course, coupled with this huge rise in population, that you will begin to have in certain areas, I mean, in the fairly near future, actually, such water shortages that the population will actually have to start leaving the countryside and pouring into the towns. This then will worsen every social tension, increase support for radicalization, increase local ethnic tensions.
Fascinating, Anatole. Thank you again for joining us on our program. And thank you very much for joining us for this conversation with history.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.